from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Spread across Iran, Turkey, Iraq, Syria, and Armenia is one of the world's largest stateless people, the Kurds. Members of the ethnic group have survived generations of discrimination and violence. They were crucial in the fight against ISIS and also in Iraq. Now, Kurds face new threats as the U.S. withdraws from northern Syria. It is not the first time the safety of the Kurds in the Middle East has hinged on U.S. policy. So we wanted to hear from Kurds here in the United States about their reaction to the president's decision to withdraw from northern Syria, what it means for their families, as well as about what it means for them as Kurdish Americans. So this hour on Point, a roundtable of Kurdish American voices. And you can join us. Are you a Kurdish American? Has your family been affected by the withdrawal of U.S. troops from northern Syria? And we will hear from this roundtable in just a moment. But first, let us go to northern Syria for an update on the humanitarian situation there. Richard Engel joins us. He's NBC News' chief foreign correspondent. He's with us from northern Syria. Richard, welcome to On Point.
Hi, it's good to be with you. Thank you for including me in your conversation. I think it's going to be a very interesting one. I think you're going to see a lot of or hear from a lot of people who are at a low point. They thought that the Kurds were finally going to get a place that they could call their home, a place where they could be comfortable being Kurdish, have a degree of autonomy here in Syria. And they had it for a little while, and now they are being driven from their homes. There is still an ongoing offensive right now. It is being carried out by Turkey, but it is not as visible as it was, I would say, a week or so ago when there was an open Turkish invasion with aircraft and artillery. There is still some of that, but now it is mostly Turkish-backed militias that are going through towns, through villages, and pushing people out or frightening people out of their homes. So the Kurds here said they are facing an ethnic cleansing campaign that is not always obvious to see when the big Turkish guns aren't firing, but which they absolutely feel. And to make matters far, far more worse, there are still American troops in this country, and they have been ordered by President Trump not to intervene, not to help their allies who fought with them against ISIS. Instead, they've been told to relocate other areas to protect oil fields. So a very, very disturbing situation, a historic moment for the Kurdish people who had something historic, who had something that they were incredibly proud of here in Syria, that they were calling Rojava, an autonomous area, which I think you're gonna hear that word a lot over the course of your conversation. And now that autonomous enclave, Rojava, is being wiped out as American troops are being pulled to other areas. Well, maybe it can rebuild, but this is a tough moment.
Yeah. So Richard, let me ask you. I mean, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of people already forced out. Is that right?
That is. So this enclave, the numbers are always somewhat in dispute how many Kurds there are and how many Kurds, but the general number you hear thrown around is about 2 million here in some of your college or something. Your roundtable might dispute that number, but let's say roughly 2 million just in this pocket. And for the last 5 years, they have been fighting alone, U.S. troops, really elite U.S. troops, against ISIS. They lost 11,000 men and women. The Kurds here had a unique fighting force that where men and women were together on the front lines together. They also had shared government. So in every government position, they had one man and one woman in the same position as co-equals. They had this unique society that for the United States was a powerful counter-ISIS weapon, and for them was the seed of an incredible homeland in Syria. And now that homeland called Rojava is under attack, and there are hundreds of thousands of people who are internally displaced, not really sure where to go. Some are crossing over into Iraq. Others are going into areas that are still under Kurdish protection. Others are going into different cities that haven't quite been attacked yet. So a lot of movement going around, but hundreds of thousands of people are not where they were couple of weeks ago.
Yeah. Well, Richard Engel, NBC News' chief foreign correspondent, speaking to us from northern Syria. Richard, I'm going to turn to our Kurdish-American roundtable right now, but thank you so much for your reporting.
I look forward to it. And thank you for including me.
All right. Well, let's turn now to Shireen Zada. She joins us from San Diego, California. She's a humanitarian activist. Her parents immigrated to San Diego from Syria near the Turkish border. She has extended family who still lives in the region. Shireen Zada, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Thank you for having me today.
So first of all, tell us, what are you hearing from members of your family who are some of them still in northern Syria?
Yes, we have family in Afrin and Kobani Kemeshli area, which is on the northeastern border of Turkey, and in Aleppo. And ever since October 6th, we have not heard from them. We don't know where they are. We don't know, as Richard Engel described, if they went to Iraq or to safer cities in Syria. It's been 3 weeks of utter confusion, sadness, hurt, betrayal, emotions that so many Kurds in northeastern Syria and throughout Syria are feeling currently.
You haven't heard from them in 3 weeks, you said?
Yes.
So you don't know where they are at the moment?
No, we don't.
Oh, okay. And so when the news of President Trump's decision to withdraw U.S. troops from northern Syria, or mostly mm-hmm. withdraw, when you first heard that, at that point in time, were you able to contact your family?
Right. So on October 6th, we heard about the invasion and we were shocked. We were hoping that Trump would listen to his foreign policy advisors and military advisors and realize that withdrawing from northeastern Syria would be a catastrophic mistake regionally and globally for security. As he said in his tweet, he withdrew the troops. We texted them, we messaged them on Facebook, Viber, WhatsApp, but for the first couple of days, the connection wasn't going through, and then we weren't getting our calls returned. And usually we would be able to contact our family living there, but we haven't heard from them since then. And it's been utterly confusing. And while we have been able to contact our family in Afrin and Aleppo, they're also scared. They also don't know what's going to happen, what this withdrawal means for the security of all Kurds living in Syria, because Syrian Kurds have always been persecuted by the regime. And now, as we know, they've been forced into the arms of Assad. And this is a partnership that the Kurds definitely never wanted. Some Kurds, before the war started, some Kurds didn't even have citizenship. Just speaking Kurdish could land you in the notorious Syrian jail, and you didn't want to end up there. And the intelligence agency was so tightly controlled in Syria that if you even heard speaking Kurdish, you would vanish for days, and your family wouldn't know where you were, your friends, they would hear nothing, and sometimes you would reappear, and sometimes you wouldn't.
Huh. Well, so it seems as if the Kurds have repeatedly found themselves in situations like this, that perhaps yes. there's this surge of hope. You heard Richard Engel say that before the president's announcement, there was this sense of hope about what could be created in yeah. northern Syria. Was Richard accurate in saying that?
Absolutely. While he was talking, I had just flashbacks to my cousins talking about the change of the feeling within society towards men and women. I mean, as Reggie Engel describes, this was an oasis of democracy, of gender equality, of egalitarianism. Women and men were equal on the battlefield, in the political boardroom, socially. It was the first time we had in this region women were seen as equals. And we needed them to come on the front lines. We needed them to fight the worst enemy the world has ever experienced, ISIS, the greatest threat to the greatest terrorism threat to the world. And they came out and people realized that Kurdish women, that women in this region, they needed to be empowered. And it took this fight against ISIS for Kurdish women to be recognized for their full social, militarily, and political potential. And it was an absolutely thriving democracy. It was Rojava was an experiment in gender equality. And until 3 weeks ago, what we saw was absolutely inspiring.
And all of that is risks
gone.
You say yeah. it's already gone.
It's you can make a very bad decision less bad if you try. But I don't know if President Trump is on that track right now, and it is. It's a risk of complete annihilation, risk of completely falling apart. And again, now that these women know that they can get there can get equal rights and can be empowered. I don't know if that will ever change, the sense of within Kurdish society that women can be empowered. But the withdrawal of our troops, the complete abandonment of our greatest ally and leaving them to the threat of complete destruction, it's going to be an ethnic cleansing, a genocide. As Richard Engel today has reported, and many of his segments has reported, what we're seeing is one of the worst genocides in the 21st century. And if we don't act, we don't know how many more lives are going to be lost. I mean, already 200,000 Kurds have been displaced. And it speaks to the larger issue of, as an American, I'm a Kurdish American. My dad immigrated here in 1982. And I love America more than anything. And for me to have seen my country abandon the Kurds, the only ally we had in the fight against ISIS, hurt on so many levels. One, as a global citizen, I'm scared of what's going to happen to the security of the world if we don't have loyal and reliable partners on the ground to fight against ISIS. And now that we abandoned the Kurds, the only group of people who have proved themselves to be loyal partners, I'm just wondering, as an American, who are we going to go turn to next if we showed the world that once we're done with a group of people, we turn our backs against them?
Hmm. Well, we are talking this hour with a roundtable of Kurdish American voices. When we come back from the break, we'll introduce two more voices into this conversation. And we want to hear from you. What are your questions or your comments for these Kurdish Americans about their people, about the possibilities that they saw for at least a moment in northern Syria, about the impact of U.S. policy on the Kurdish people over time, not just this year, but for many decades? This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're hearing this hour from a roundtable of Kurdish American voices about how they see this moment regarding U.S. policy in northern Syria and also the history of U.S. policy and its impact on the Kurdish people. Let's actually listen for a moment to voices from Syria itself. Kurdish Syrian resident Abdul Wakil spoke to the Voice of America last week about the impact of the U.S. withdrawal and subsequent Turkish incursions on northern Syria, the impact that that has already had on his life.
We dreamed of safe Rojava. We dreamed it would be safe, that we can sleep in the streets, and that our shops were always open for business. But now safety is not possible.
Kurdish school teacher Naja Rasso told NPR a couple of weeks ago how that Turkish incursion in northern Syria has affected her family.
I love Rojava, but I'm afraid not just for me, but for my daughter. When the Turkish airstrike started a few days ago, she was terrified. We didn't believe we would see the sunrise.
That's a Kurdish school teacher speaking to NPR. I'm joined today by Shireen Zada. She joins us from San Diego, California. She's a humanitarian activist. Her family originally hails from Afrin in Syria. Joining us now as well from Nashville, Tennessee, is Jihan Mohammed. Jihan was raised in Dohuk, Iraq, and taught at the University of Dohuk for 3 years. She's a PhD candidate at Michigan State University right now, where she's writing her dissertation on Iraqi Sunni and Shia communities. She's also an adjunct professor at Motlow State Community College in Tennessee. And by the way, Nashville happens to have the largest Kurdish population in the United States. Jihan Mohammed, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you. And also with us from Chicago, Illinois, is Mateen Serbest. Mateen moved to Chicago from Turkey in the year 2000 to attend Northwestern University for his master's degree in law. He's a lawyer specializing in immigration and international human rights. Mateen Serbest, welcome to you.
Thank you. Wake now.
So first of all, Jihan, let me ask you a question that I asked Shireen in the segment prior. What was your first response, your first reaction when you heard about the U.S. change in policy in northern Syria?
Well, I personally was not surprised or shocked by Mr. President's decision to withdraw, given the history of how the United States and Western powers has handled the Kurdish issue in the Middle East. It was expected. Some people were actually waiting for that to happen. So I was not surprised. The element of surprise was in the behavior of Trump's and the way he, I mean, the lack of empathy and the amount of misinformation he tweeted and keep tweeting and speaking on behalf of the Kurds and claiming that the Kurds are actually happy about the quote-unquote deal, while the truth is we are not happy about the deal. And so that was the element of surprise and just, you know, describing this this conflict as, you know, using some very offensive and, if you will, racist terms and sentences. It was hard to watch that.
Mateen, same question to you.
Magna, well, I was surprised. At least I thought that human dignity and ethics would not allow anyone, even Trump, to betray their allies, especially vulnerable people who fought and lost 12,000 fighters to defend not just their land but also Western values. So I was surprised, yes. I mean, I thought even he wouldn't do such a thing.
And Shireen, let me turn back to you here because I feel like perhaps help educate us all. I'd appreciate all three of you to help educate all of us here on some basics, in fact, because for many American people, we hear about the plight of the Kurds somewhat periodically, right, when there's this change in U.S. policy, you know, thinking all the way back to, you know, U.S. involvement in Iraq or ongoing involvement in Iraq. But when we speak of the Kurdish people, Shireen, who are we talking about?
Well, we're talking about the largest minority in the world without a homeland, right, as you mentioned earlier in the segment. We're talking about a people that have historically always aligned with the United States. We're talking about a people that have faced persecution in every country in the middle, in Turkey, Iran, Iraq, and Syria. And what the Kurdish people have craved ever since the fall of the Ottoman Empire is independence, statehood. And this has been an elusive dream that the Kurdish people have not been able to obtain. And up until recently, I was really surprised by the withdrawal for a couple of reasons. One, as you know, our guest mentioned earlier, the complete abandonment of our Western values of loyalty, of preserving freedom and democracy was shocking, especially in a region rifled with conflict. I mean, like we've been discussing, Rojava was this experiment in democracy and a war-torn country in Syria, right? And it's a country that has experienced so much conflict over the past 7-8 years. And to see the United States, the largest military power in the world, the leader of the free world, tell the world that, you know, we're not going to protect this ethnic minority, this group of people that lost 12,000 lives to fight against ISIS, the greatest terror threat the world has ever seen in this 21st century, and we're going to let them into the hands of Turkey. And second of all, I don't understand how this preserves our foreign policy strength. I interned for the State Department, and I have always been a believer that we need to ensure that our foreign policy remains strong, because I believe a strong United States can mean a more peaceful Middle East. And to allow Russia, Iran, and Assad, and Turkey to take our place, to give Russia foothold in the Middle East, speaks to a potentially dangerous situation down the road.
And Jihan, we've heard this phrase Rojava several times here. Explain what does Rojava mean? What is it intended to? What was it intended to mean?
So Rojava is, I believe, it's perceived by many Kurds as a replica of Kurdistan Regional Government in Iraq. Mm-hmm. It is a territory controlled by Kurdish forces in northern Syria, and it was formed after the Arab Spring in Syria. So the Kurds were able to control their own territories and form this form of governance that is democratic, egalitarian, and inspired by secular values. So what the Kurds in Syria were hoping is to have, you know, a replica of KRG in Syria and a place where they feel protected and their rights are preserved and their culture and language and folklore and everything is protected. But now, as Shireen said, that's probably all gone and we don't probably will not have Rojava anymore if, you know, we don't get enough help from the U.S. and allies to keep this form of governance in Syria. So Syrian Kurds are protected as well.
Mm. And I ask because, Mateen, it seems as if the United States, with some frequency, looks to the Kurdish people as potential pillars or exemplars of the kind of governance and the kind of societies that the U.S. would like to see in the Middle East. We've done this before.
Well, if I understood your question correctly, did you mean U.S. government or the American people?
The government.
The government.
Yes.
Well, I mean, the Kurds especially the Iraqi Kurds, were able to accomplish some semi-sovereign government, which is called KRG, in the east, and also in the west. It would also, with Rojava experience, would be the second Kurdish semi-government at this point that would also... let's remember that those governments, the Kurdish governments especially, are pro multicultural governments. They have the element of tolerance in their system. If you look at the Rojava constitution or even KRG constitution, you'll see that all of the religions, the segments, are referred to. They're respected, whereas you see the rest of the Middle East not gender equal, and also oppression-based authorities are ruling. So yes, it would benefit the Western countries and U.S. government to have similar structures in the Middle East.
Hmm. Jihan, let me turn back to you here, because we could and we'll spend some time talking about policy here, because it's kind of sort of a natural center of gravity. But really what I'd love to hear from you is more about how conflict in the Middle East, how being Kurdish has shaped your life. I mean, tell us about your childhood. In the first, I don't know, 10 years of your life, what was that like?
So I was born in the middle of the Iraq-Iran war that started in 1980 and lasted until 1988. And, you know, my childhood was, you know, surrounded by conflicts and chaos between the Kurds and the Iraqi central government, and other times by the conflicts between Iraq and Iran. At the age of five, I was displaced with another 2 million Iraqi Kurds because in 1991, Iraqi Kurds started an uprising against the oppressive regime of Saddam Hussein, and then he counterattacked the Kurdish forces in north and the Shia forces in the south. So, and because we were scared that he might use chemical weapons, mm-hmm. given the fact he previously used it in 1988, mm-hmm. You know, to kill thousands of Kurds. So people were afraid that he is going to use them again. So we left our houses behind. And in fact, the Kurdistan region or the Kurdish cities in northern Iraq. Back then, it was not yet a Kurdish. There was no Kurdish government back then. It was, you know, they were like town, ghost towns. So at the age of five, I had to, you know, run away from my home. And I remember just walking and for, I don't know, several days, and everyone was just running and kids crying. And, you know, the experience of displaced people, it's very, it's traumatic. It is one of the hardest journeys I've ever done in my life. And after several days, we reached the safety, and we stayed for a few months. Then we were lucky to be able to come back to our houses. And luckily, my house was not destroyed by the bombs. Other houses in the neighborhood next to mine, they were actually destroyed. Mm. Before that, you know, when I was a kid, you know, once you hear the sirens going off, that means one thing: you have to run to a shelter. So you would try to find a shelter at your neighbor's house or at your cousin's house. That's how my child was, you know. Yeah. That's in early 1990s.
So as a five-year-old in 1991, the early 1990s, you experienced, it sounds like, almost exactly what Kurdish children in northern Syria may be experiencing right now.
Exactly. And it's hard to watch these images coming from the conflict area because, you know, it reminds. And to be clear, my experience is not unique. This mine is a typical story of, you know, a Kurdish child who's been either displaced or, you know, whose parents are executed and killed, or siblings are killed and executed for the fact of simply being Kurd and resisting to the oppressive policies of Middle Eastern states of Turkey, Iran, Syria, and Iraq. So I am one of the luckiest, you know, because I survived. I was not killed. Another thousands of Kurds didn't make it. They were actually killed.
Mm-hmm. Shireen, Jihan just told us that she feels extremely lucky because even as a five-year-old, though they had to flee, they were able at least to temporarily return to their home. Do you imagine that a similar hope or possibility exists for the Kurds being removed from northern Syria right now?
Absolutely. You know, we were just discussing the miracle of Rojava, and I would assume that the hopes of so many Kurds in northeastern Syria is to return to where we were a month ago, where we were living in a relatively peaceful state, given that this is located in Syria. And it's a hope that many Kurds are holding on to. And when you watch the reports that Richard Engel does and other foreign correspondents, they speak to the Kurds on the ground and they ask them what they want. And they'll say, our whole future, our lives are dependent on the tweets that Trump makes at 4 or 5 a.m. And he maybe doesn't understand the scope, the severity of what he is saying, of what he's telling the world, because when he says one thing, that ripples 7,000 miles away. And you know, Trump is saying that this conflict is 7,000 miles away from home, right? Why does it matter? And during 9/11, those jihadists didn't see 7,000 miles as a barrier. Terrorism doesn't know borders. I'm sorry, I'm making the conversation policy oriented, and you didn't ask me that yet. But I just thought that was important to acknowledge. But as you asked, yes, I do think it is a hope that many Kurds have.
Well, Mateen, we have a minute to go before the break here, since we are just temporarily back in the world of policy. And that's okay, Shireen, because these two things are overlapped. They're not separate. But Mateen, in the minute that we have left, on this very program, in previous conversations we've had about Syria, we've had callers call in who say the U.S. can't stay there forever, that the president was right to withdraw troops, even if it comes at a great cost for Kurds there. I mean, what would you say to people listening right now who feel that way?
Meghna, first of all, initially when Trump announced that he was going to bring them home, which, you know, might seem a positive move to the public, but he didn't bring them home. So the point mm-hmm. was not to bring the soldiers home. He sent some of them to protect oils in Saudi. And some are in Iraq, and none in United States yet, in home yet. So, I mean, it just hurts the Kurds only. To make such a move at cost of, you know, lives.
Well, Mateen, stand by here for just a second. You're listening to Mateen Serbest, Jihan Mohammed, and Shireen Zada. They are a roundtable of Kurdish-American voices talking to us today about how they view this moment and the U.S. decision to withdraw from northern Syria. We'll take a bunch of callers when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Shinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're hearing this hour from a roundtable of Kurdish-American voices and their view of this moment and how U.S. policy is having an impact on the Kurdish people. I'm joined today by Shireen Zada. She's with us from San Diego, California. Her parents immigrated to California from Afrin, Syria. She still also has family in Syria, though, as Shireen has been telling us, haven't been able to contact her extended family in several weeks. Jihan Mohammed joins us from Nashville, Tennessee. Jihan was raised in Dohuk, Iraq. She also taught at the University of Dohuk for 3 years. She's currently a PhD candidate at Michigan State University. She lives in Nashville, which has the largest Kurdish population in the United States. And Mateen Serbest joins us from Chicago, Illinois. Mateen moved to Chicago from Turkey in 2000 to attend Northwestern University for his master's in law, and he's a lawyer specializing in immigration and international human rights. And let's go to our phones. Ben is calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Ben, you're on the air.
Hi. I have a comment. I do understand what everybody is saying, and I appreciate all these concerns. I'm a Kurdish American from Iran, and I empathize and sympathize with the Rojava people. I do want to point out that this issue of the Kurdish suppression and persecution has been going on for a long time. So although this particular case is extremely tragic, it's not going to be the end of the Kurdish suppression. So we need to address this on a much global, bigger, larger level, which is especially the European countries who are responsible for the disruption and the division of the Kurdish peoples should be held to a higher standard, and they should be held responsible for what they did. Mm-hmm. And the United States should take on the Europeans and then probably create a coalition to protect all the Kurds from all these countries, because this movie will repeat itself over and over, as it has in the past.
Well, Ben, thank you for your call. Jihan, would you like to respond to him?
Yes, I totally agree with him. And if you dig into the history, what happened two weeks ago is actually not new. It's been happening since 1920s when Middle Eastern nation states were established. So if you look at how the USA and European countries handled the Kurdish issue, it is a very typical behavior, supporting the Kurds at a certain moment and then immediately abandoning them. We can start, you know, from 1920 and the Treaty of Sèvres, the Treaty of Lausanne. The Kurds were promised their own land, and but then the Turks were able to speak to the U.S. and Britain and France and change their mind, and you know, these territories were curved up to be what we know today as in Turkey, and the Kurds were left out. And we can go on and talk about what happened in the 60s, what happened in the 70s, what happened in the 90s under different American administrations, under the Bush, Nixon, and Reagan, you know, same behavior has happened. They would ally with the Kurds and use them as proxies to achieve specific political and economic goals. And once those goals are achieved, then they just, you know, end the support and or just stay silent. I can give an example of President Bush in early 1990s, when he somehow encouraged Kurds and Shias to stand up against Saddam Hussein, mm-hmm. and the Kurds took that as, you know, a word that they will get support if they initiate an uprising, and that's exactly what they did. And once they did that, they were abandoned, and that's why, for example, I left my house. We had to run away because nobody was there to protect us. And then Bush revised his, you know, decision, and he came back to create a safe zone. In 60s and 70s, you know, they would keep supporting the Kurds and giving them arms to, I don't know, to destabilize Saddam Hussein's regime and the Iraqi government. And then once that was done, you know, America was silent. For example, America did not do anything when Saddam Hussein used the chemical weapons against the Kurds, and America did not do absolutely anything.
And also who sold Saddam Hussein those weapons as well.
Exactly. I mean, yeah. The same weapons were used against us later on. That's why at the beginning of this interview, I told you I'm not surprised if you look at the history and how many times the Kurds were betrayed, not only by the U.S., but by European countries as well. This is a very actual typical behavior. And it's unfortunate to see how the Kurdish issue is handled.
Well, Jihan, you make a really interesting point, because we've actually heard this before. It wasn't all that long ago where we were doing another program on Syria, and we actually got a call. Someone called in, a Kurdish American named Agit, who called us from Vermont, and he shared his experience fighting for the International Freedom Battalion in northern Syria in 2017. And here's what he said.
While fighting there, I was very much of the opinion, as I still am, that U.S. NATO imperialism is one of the pivotal issues in the region, and that the U.S. only used the Kurds in an alliance of convenience. And I believe that the Kurds now have no choice but to go to Assad and Russia to provide for their security and safety, or else they will be decimated by the Turks, and who are supported by the U.S. and are, of course, a pivotal ally of NATO.
So that's caller Agit, who called us a couple of weeks ago from Vermont. Shireen Zada, I wanted to ask you about this, because Agit called it the long historical memory of the Kurds. And Jihan has gone through the multiple times where the Kurdish people have been betrayed by, you know, whether it's the United States, Europe, coalitions of various sorts here. But have the Kurdish people felt at any time that they had any alternative choice other than to ally with the United States or Europe?
Right. That's a great question. And it makes me think of what Richard Engel said a couple of days ago when he was talking about General Muslim's conversation with President Trump, and he thanked President Trump. And people were asking themselves, why would General Muslim thank President Trump for leaving his people to get slaughtered by Turkish forces? And Richard Engel said, well, who else does he have? He'll thank anyone who makes sure that his people who fought global terrorism won't get massacred and slaughtered. And the Kurds have historically always been, and especially now, are in a position of absolute no power. Any cards that the Kurdish Syrians had were when they were aligned with the U.S. Now that they're abandoned, they turn to the Assad regime, which, as I mentioned earlier in the segment, has historically persecuted the Kurds throughout the history of Syria. And so the question now is, what can the Kurdish Syrians do to prevent themselves from mass slaughter? And I do believe that if we can reevaluate the situation on the ground and understand the security and the regional global security threats it presents, maybe we should consider sending troops back in. And I just want to state that I do support an eventual withdrawal from Syria. I don't think we should be in the Middle East forever. That's not America's job. However, what Trump did was the opposite of sustainable. It further ignited an already tense region into an area of intense conflict that we've been seeing play out for the past couple of weeks. And we need a more,
Oh, no, I'm sorry, Shireen. I didn't mean to interrupt you there. Go ahead and complete your thought.
The last thought was, we just need a comprehensive resolution, not a tweet at 5 in the morning withdrawing our troops and then sending 200 troops to go guard the oil. Yeah.
Well, let's go to Jose, who's calling from Tamarack, Florida. Jose, you're on the air.
Hi. The reason I'm calling is from the view of, I used to be a special operator. I was with the Rangers and I was with Special Forces. And when you do this, we count on these relationships to perform our operations. They are deep relationships that take a long time for them to trust us and for us to trust them. And by doing this, the president is a coward, and we need to call him out. He's a coward, and he's ignorant on the subject, and that's the only thing. The only thing he's doing is hurting not only special operators but just regular units out there. It destroys the basic of the special operations, which is creating relationships with the population so that we can work easily there.
And
so
Jose, were you special for? Did you serve in Iraq?
I served in Iraq, but it hurts me that other special operators are not calling and saying what a disaster this is for the special operations community.
Well, Jose, thank you for your call. Let's go to Dan, who's calling from Aventura, Florida. Dan, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thank you very much. And first of all, I don't know what we do without NPR, and that's, I'm not kidding, really. Thank goodness for your show, and thank goodness for that lovely young woman there. Ironically, the caller, Jose, stole my thunder or something. I was going to say exactly the same thing and truly and use the exact same words. I think when I heard this, and I was a semi-quote-unquote Trump supporter, when I heard what he did, allowing Turkey to come in there and destroy people who fought side by side with us and shed their blood, men and women and children, I absolutely, well, that was it. I don't think he's fit to be the third-line dog catcher. I wouldn't vote for him. I mean, this is absolutely something you don't do in life, hopefully. Not your wife, not your friends, not certainly not the people who shed their blood for you.
Yeah.
Turkey's not shouldn't be an ally, and they shouldn't be in NATO.
Right.
But throw them out of there.
Well, Dan, I'm going to take it back from you, because thank you for drawing our attention to Turkey, specifically, Dan. And Mateen, I want to talk with you about this, because you moved to Chicago from Turkey. Just tell us, I mean, what is it like being a Kurd in Turkey now?
Sure, Magna. Before I do that, I'd like to actually thank Jose and Dan for their comments. As you can see that the army personnel is also with the Kurds. They appreciate what they're doing. The good side of, I think, this incident is to see that we have people and even politicians are behind us, behind the Kurds. They see what they're going through. It is unfortunate to leave the destiny of the oppressed people of the Kurds to just one person. So with that being said, in Turkey, I was born in 75. So in 1980s, there was a coup, coup was done by a fascist general. After the coup, thousands of Kurds and minorities and dissent were jailed, tortured. Matter of fact, I think most of the Kurdish politicians that are in the political arena right now are the ones that experienced such maltreatment in 1980s. So I don't remember much of that, but in 1985 or so, I moved from a little Kurdish town to Western Turkey, and I started my sixth grade without actually knowing Turkish. So I personally, as a 11-year-old kid, felt the discrimination, also not being able to communicate with other members, other children, even teachers. So it's that for a child to go through such a thing, I think, is too much. Now, as you probably following, I mean, the Kurds in four parts of Kurdistan, I'm not going to call it Kurdistan. I know some people may not like that, but that's what it is. In four parts of Kurdistan are experiencing similar experiences. They're going through the same destiny, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. So in Turkey... Yes. Did you want to interrupt, or I could go on?
Well, I'm just mindful of the time. So people always say, gosh, you're so rude, Meghna, cutting off your guests, but I'm just mindful of the time. But I did want to, Mateen, just briefly, I wanted to ask you one more thing about Turkey and the Kurdish people, because, I mean, as you well know, Turkey views the Kurds, definitely the Kurds in northern Syria, in the Turkish government's eyes, as terrorists. And so therefore, they feel completely justified in the actions they're taking. And just briefly, your response to that.
Meghna, I'm going to actually expose myself to the public. As a Kurd, as a Kurd who lives in the United States as a Kurdish American, I am opponent of the Turkish policies. And even just being an opponent is good enough for you to be called terrorist. So the other week I actually asked Turkish consulate to actually welcome the new Turkish consulate in Chicago. And guess what? I was refused. So with that much being said, I mean, you can't even imagine what the rest of minorities or dissent in Turkey are going through. Forget about, carrying arms. Even one word is good enough for you to be actually marked. As an immigration attorney, I actually have to address this as well, if you don't mind.
Yeah, we have a couple seconds, though.
Sure. We have thousands of Kurds at Mexican border entering to the United States, and most of them are, I have about 20 probably detainees right now that are Kurdish from Turkey. So they are fleeing from Turkey, and what they are going through, even in Turkey, is inhumane. They are being persecuted, basically.
Jihan Mohammed, we have 30 seconds left, and I was just wondering if you had wanted to share a last thought with us.
I just want to point out that these nation states calling the Kurds as terrorists or rebellions is so unfair, because this ethnic group, and to speak for other minorities such as the Yazidis and others, they're all trying to survive. They have never initiated a war themselves. They're just resisting to the oppression, persecution, ethnic cleansing and genocide. And, referring to them as terrorists is wrong, and it's very unfair.
Well, Jihan Mohammed, joining us from Nashville, Tennessee, Shireen Zada with us from San Diego, California, and Mateen Serbest joining us from Chicago, Illinois. I want to thank all three of you today so much for sharing your voices in this Kurdish American Roundtable. Thank you very much. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. ¶¶